Did you notice that the days are just a wee bit shorter now? You know, nothing to do with daylight savings time. They should be getting longer. Well, that giant 9-0 Japanese earthquake shook up the entire planet, and it shifted the Earth's axis. Yeah, shortening the day just a teeny weeny little bit. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the earthquake shifted some global positioning stations, you know, GPS stations in the country, and one near the epicenter moved 13 feet. Wow. To put it in another way, Japan is wider now than it was before, said one USGS scientist. Joining me now to talk more about it is Richard Gross. He's a research scientist in the Geodesy and Space Group at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to join you.
What is the Space Geodesy Group about at NASA?
Well, we use space geodetic measurements such as from GPS to study how the planet deforms and its rotation changes as a result of mass motion within and on the Earth.
And you can tell from the GPS things around the countryside that you have placed around there?
Yeah, there's a worldwide network of GPS receivers that we use that continually monitor how the Earth is rotating.
And this was such a big earthquake that it changed the rotation of the Earth.
According to a calculation I did, it should have gotten the days should have gotten shorter by about 1.8 microseconds. That's 1.8 millionths of a second.
1.8 millionths of a second. Not something we're really going to notice, but I would imagine to scientists that's an important number.
Yes, the Earth's rotation changes all the time. The length of the day changes mostly in response to changes in the atmospheric winds. And these winds, the effect of the winds can be 500 times larger than this effect of the earthquake. And we need to account for these changes in the length of the day at JPL because it affects how we navigate spacecraft to planets like Mars.
Huh. And what other things affect it? You know, I know we have melting glaciers and water sloshing and things like that. Would that also affect the rotation?
Yeah, it certainly does. Anything that moves mass around will, in principle, affect the Earth's rotation. But in order for it to have a measurable effect, it has to be a lot of mass. So changes in the atmosphere, changes in the oceans, melting ice off Greenland, all of these can affect the Earth's rotation.
And what about the axis? Was the axis tilted any?
The Earth rotates about its rotation axis, but the mass of the Earth is not balanced about that axis. If the mass of the Earth were balanced about that axis, it would spin very smoothly, just like a well-balanced tire on your car spins smoothly. But the mass of the Earth is not balanced about its rotation axis, and so it wobbles as it rotates, just like an out-of-balance tire on your car vibrates as it rotates. And it's that axis about which the mass is balanced is what shifted during this earthquake. The earthquake rearranges the mass of the Earth, and therefore the figure axis moved by about 6.5 inches.
So it's like somebody moved one of those little weights on your tire when they bang it in with the hammer.
Exactly. And it's the global displacement of the mass of the Earth that was important for the Earth rotation to change.
And what kind of instruments? You mentioned the space probes that NASA might send. Tell me about what kind of the what's out there now and what kinds of things might be affected. Are these things that are far away near, you know, circulating Saturn or are they stuff that's right near the Earth here?
Well, every satellite that is launched to the planets like Mars or Saturn or asteroids, when we navigate those planets to those spacecraft to make sure that we target, you know, accurately approach the target body, we have to account for these kinds of changes in the Earth's rotation. It turns out that if you were to simply assume that the Earth were rotating uniformly without, any change, you could be off by kilometers in the position of where you want to land a rover on Mars.
Yeah. Now you said that your one of your GPS stations moved almost 13 feet. Is that common? Something like that?
For these really great earthquakes, stations close to the source of the earthquake can move many feet like that, many meters. Of course, the motion gets much smaller as you move farther away from the source of the earthquake. But even a few thousand kilometers away, you can still have displacements of a millimeter or so.
Well, you know, that's how mountains get pushed up, right? We have these earthquakes or these tectonic events. A little 13 feet here, a little 10 feet there. Soon you got the Himalayas.
That's right. Over time, all of these small displacements caused by earthquakes build up, and that's how mountains form. That's right.
It's just amazing to think about how many it must have taken to throw up these giant mountains, how long over a period of time, and how many different earthquakes must have happened.
Yeah, well, the tectonic plates that make up the crust of the Earth have been moving for, you know, millions, even hundreds of millions of years, causing these mountains to grow.
Mm-hmm. And now you've done a computer model on this. How can you verify that it's correct, your calculation? Is there any way to do that?
Yes, we can look at the GPS measurements we have of the change in the Earth's rotation and try to see if we can detect what I calculated the earthquake should have caused. And this will be a bit challenging because it's a small signal, and there are these other mechanisms like the atmosphere and oceans that cause much bigger changes in the Earth's rotation. Mm-hmm. So we'll take the observations and we'll remove these larger effects due to the atmosphere and oceans, and with any luck, we'll see this smaller signal caused by the earthquake.
Mm-hmm. This is NPR Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And we're talking about the earthquake and what it did to the rotation of the Earth. Have there been bigger ones than this that have shifted the wobble and the axis and stuff on the Earth?
There have certainly been bigger earthquakes on the Earth. In fact, the largest earthquake that's been recorded was in 1960 in Chile, and I did a similar calculation for that earthquake, and according to my calculation, it should have changed the length of the day by about 8 microseconds.
Is it? Wow. Is there any way you can run your computer model backwards to see, you know, the past histories of where earthquakes might have happened or the wobble may have changed eons ago?
Well, I use seismic information for how the fault slipped during the earthquake.
Right.
So I need that information to do my model. And so I can only run my model on the earthquakes that I have that information, which only spans about the last 30 years or so.
And so your model doesn't have any predictive value about predicting when we might have another earthquake.
Oh, no, of course not. This model just computes the consequence of the earthquake on the Earth's rotation.
Mm-hmm. And this earthquake has been pretty well monitored, has it not? I mean, you're in Japan. They have earthquakes there all the time. There are sensors all over the world and certainly all over that Ring of Fire area. There must be an awful lot of data that scientists have been collecting on this earthquake.
Yes, that's right. Japan is one of the best instrumented countries in the world as far as seismometers and GPS receivers go. And so this is one of the best recorded earthquakes. And hopefully by analyzing all of this data in the future, we'll have a better understanding of how really great earthquakes like this occur.
And maybe someplace puts this data together and might see a precursor that might have hinted and tell us when to expect another one.
That is one of the things that the scientists are certainly looking at. With having such a wealth of data from this earthquake, not only during the earthquake, but before and after, they'll certainly be looking for those precursors.
Mm-hmm. And a quake like this, even though you talked about it moving, you know, the Japan just a little bit wider, does it move to the other, does it cause stuff on the other side of the earth to change also?
In principle, it will, but by such a small amount that there's no hope of measuring it. You can measure the changes up to maybe a few thousand kilometers away, but that's about as far as you'll be able to see the displacements.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go with your research now? What would you like to do next?
Well, actually, my next research project is what you mentioned, having to do with melting ice off of Greenland and Antarctica. I'm currently looking into the impact that will have on the Earth's rotation.
Oh, you mean as global warming melts the ice off the continents and they start flooding into the ocean, we're going to have more water, more liquid water.
Exactly. As all that meltwater flows into the oceans, it raises the level of the oceans, and that can change the Earth's rotation.
Wow. You know, we think about it, but we don't think of all the consequences. That's why you guys are out there doing it.
Yeah, well, for most people, these small changes in the Earth's rotation have no consequence, but it's important for us at JPL when we navigate spacecraft.
And there you have it. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, and good luck on your mathematics.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Richard Gross, a research scientist in the Geodynamics and Space Geodesy Group at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, of course, that's in Pasadena. That's about all the time we have for our program. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata, Catherine Wells, Leisha Bayak. Neil Rausch is our technical director. Manoli Weatherill at the controls here in New York today. Sam Flato is our intern. If you missed any part of the program, go over to iTunes, subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video, and you can download them. Then they'll come right to your computer on your iPhone and your Android app, or you can go to our website at Science Friday and take Science Friday along with you on your apps and continue week-long discussions on Twitter. We'll still be tweeting at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and conversation continuing on our Facebook page. And while you're on our, when you're on our homepage at sciencefriday.com, take our survey. We need a few more folks to give us their opinions about being part of our Science Friday survey. So just click on the survey button there. And if you'd like to become part of our focus group, let us know. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
Washington, D.C. is in the midst of celebrating all things Indian, a 3-week festival of dance, music, theater. There are antique saris and contemporary art on display. And for a taste of India, the festival turned to the country's top chef, Hemant Oberoi.
India is a vast country of 25,000 dishes, 25,000 recipes, known, unknown. And I want everybody to enjoy the best.
Hemant Oberoi is in charge of all the restaurants in the luxury hotel group The Taj. That's more than 100. He works out of its legendary Taj Mahal Palace and Towers in Mumbai. We joined him in the kitchen at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts to get a demonstration of some of the dishes he's offering, including this one, Kali Mirch Kamurk.
Which is a chicken with the peppercorns. You heat up the oil, you add a little bit of the cumin seeds, you add the chopped onions, you add the chopped ginger, half a teaspoon of the garlic paste. If you don't get the sound of crackling of the cumin seeds, you can never make a good food.
That's one of the key moments when you know it's working, is when you hear the cumin seeds rattling in the pan.
This chicken is already marinated with yogurt. Mm-hmm. So here we add the crushed peppercorns to the dish. Now I'm going to finish it with a little cream.
And I can see the cream is absorbing all those, all the onions and the spices, and turning a little light brown.
Cooking is the easiest thing in life. I enjoy what I do.
Yeah.
Although that's not what I wanted to do in life.
You wanted to be a doctor?
I wanted to be a doctor. Then I wanted to be an army officer.
There's a joke in India that the career choices that make the most desirable husbands are doctors and engineers. So Oberoi says his family was shocked 40 years ago when he went into cooking. There were no models for such a career, but he became known for bringing international cuisine to India in a series of elegant restaurants. And before opening his first Indian restaurant in 2002, he spent a year traveling around his country in search of the authentic, dishes that would never be offered in a five-star hotel.
I wanted to bring back the forgotten recipes, and I wanted to make sure that we don't open another Indian restaurant where it is only tandoori chicken and biryani and kebabs. That you can get in all the restaurants.
One dish in particular that Oberoi rediscovered made a new hit out of a traditional worker's lunch, a dish that had all but disappeared, atta chicken, which roughly translates to dough chicken. It dates back to a time in Punjab province when every little house had a kind of brick oven known as a tandoori.
And in the olden days, the lady of the house will marinate the chicken in the night, wrap it with the leftover dough of the bread, and she will leave it in the tandoori oven on a slow fire. By the morning when the man of the house was ready to go to for work, he would carry the chicken, which was fully baked, and the bread was baked and the chicken was cooked. That was a atta chicken, which was probably in 30s and 1930s, 1940s, it was prevalent. We brought the dish back. Within 6 months to 8 months, all over Punjab, the original atta chicken, all the outlets came up, and hundreds of them now.
So you can take credit for, like, atta chicken joints all over Punjab.
That's okay, yeah.
Chef Oberoi shared several recipes with us at the Kennedy Center Kitchen, and you can see them on our website. Essential to most is that very Indian mix of spices, cumin, cardamom, coriander, cloves, and more, called garam masala.
Garam masala is a magical powder. It varies from a person to person, grandmother's secret recipe to mother's secret recipe to so on.
And is this your secret recipe?
Not so. I'm very open about the things. No two people can make the same food the same way.
Chef Oberoi operates 7 restaurants in just the Taj Mahal Palace. And he was there at its most tragic moment back in 2008 when terrorists attacked Mumbai. The gunmen roamed the halls of the Taj for hours, shooting anyone they saw.
I got a call from one of my chefs. Chef, there's a shooting going on. In a minute, I said, close the door, switch off the lights. That's how 120 people's lives were saved, because the lights were switched off and the doors were closed. And they walked past those restaurants. And then there was a banquet going on where we had a wedding of 200 people. We immediately closed the doors, brought everybody from the back areas into a safe area behind my office. And we made sure they are looked after in the night, because from 9 o'clock till 1:30, people were hungry also, although they were scared. So in fact, my team was making sandwiches. My team was looking after the fresh tea, coffee being served to them in spite of everything going on.
And this is when you say everything going on, this was where the hotel, parts of it were on fire?
Yeah, we knew where the fire is taking place. We were trying to make sure that all the guests are safe.
Of the more than 170 people who died that day in Mumbai, 31 were in the Taj, including 7 of Hemant Oberoi's chefs.
Was it hard to go back in after the hotel
was
repaired?
Not really. We reopened in 21 days with a new cutlery, new crockery, new glassware.
And people came?
And people came. On the opening night when we opened, there were 1,000 people in the lobby to show solidarity to us.
Hemant Oberoi is one of India's best-known chefs. He's showing off his country's cuisine this month in Washington, D.C., at an Indian cultural festival.
The New York Times has announced a new paywall, which will require many readers to pay for visits to the newspaper's website. The Times has tried this before, but there's reason to believe this time the paywall will pay off, because reading the paper on iPads or Kindles or other tablets is a better experience. To talk more about this, we called media analyst Ken Doctor.
Publishers that I've talked to that have had products out there for a year, news reading products, are seeing that in their data. They're seeing that people are spending time, they are sitting back and largely between 6 and 9 p.m. at night. They're reading longer stories. They're spending more time per what we call session each time they go onto the tablet. And now, if we can combine the pleasure of reading a newspaper or a magazine with the digital access and the ability to watch video or share that with a friend, we may have the best of both worlds.
What do you think the New York Times really needs to happen with this?
I'm looking at the 1% rule. They have about 30 million people in the U.S. who visit their website, nytimes.com, every month. Now, only a small portion of those will ever pay, maybe no more than 5%. If they could get 1%, that would be $60, $70 million a year. That only gets them an increase of 10% compared to the circulation money they get from the newspaper today. But if they could get to that 1% level, then that's a milestone, and they can build from there.
Well, now, I guess other media have charged for online content for some time, music on iTunes, TV shows on Netflix. Do you think that consumers are just going to have to get used to paying for everything?
I think that the free world is ending. It's receding in a way, but it will never go away. In news, people still have a lot of free news and will have it from NPR, from the BBC, from other free outlets that will be there. I think that the trade-off that we're seeing, and we're seeing it in movies, we're seeing Netflix, HBO, we're seeing paying the cable people, it's a trade-off of convenience for pay. Pay us once, we'll get it to you. And if you can fulfill that and they really want what you have, then I think a significant proportion of consumers are going to go for that deal.
Well, let's turn this around for a second. You've made the point, which I think is a very interesting one, that these new devices have sort of paved the way for paying for content because they are pleasant to use. But without good content, those products wouldn't be worth much. I mean, who needs whom more? Does Apple need the New York Times more than the Times needs Apple?
At this point, the Times needs the iPad and needs the tablet more than Apple needs the New York Times. News reading is among the top three uses of the iPad. But Apple has many revenue sources, starting with hardware, software, and music. The New York Times is trying to figure out a new business model. So for the Times and newspapers, this is perhaps their last chance to charge. And if they can get us to help pay the freight of paying for those expensive newsrooms, they're grabbing at the chance.
Ken Doctor is the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get. Ken Doctor, thank you.
You're quite welcome. Good to talk to you.